Good morning. I think we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Julia Koster. I'm the leader of the Bell Tower Restoration Project, along with an amazing group of your fellow congregants. Clark Irvin has graciously loaned us the mic today so we can provide a program to really get into the details of the Bell Tower Restoration Project, and you can see literally what's happening behind the curtain, so to speak, now that's up there. It's been so exciting to us to see the scaffolding going up and to know that there's work underway to bring our bell tower back to an amazing condition that it deserves. So you are kind of seeing it sort of within the last month. So look, something's happening on the bell tower. But this represents several years' worth of work on the part particularly of our bell tower building committee as well as the fundraising committee that's been working on it. The building committee has been scoping the project, selecting the amazing design and construction team that's leading the work. So we really wanted to share an in-depth look at how we got to the project we're working on and what's happening right now. So we will have presentations today from our own Sharon Park, as well as Robert Allen. And then David Galilee will wrap things up for us with some remarks at the end. And then after that, we'll take everyone's questions. So if you can, we'll try and hold the questions until then. One quick check. Can everyone hear in the back? Fantastic. So I'm really delighted to introduce Sharon Park to start the program. Sharon has been a member of the St. John's community for over 50 years. She's an architect by training, and her specialty is historic preservation. She's served on two vestries and has been on numerous buildings and grounds committees. So that's included the accessibility ramp, the church revitalization, the parish house renovation, and now hopefully the capstone of her lengthy career with us, the bell tower. She's retired from the Smithsonian's Office of Facilities, where she was, the head of historic preservation and had to care for over 40 buildings in that particular portfolio. She also had a long and storied career with the National Park Service, where she developed a number of technical bulletins on preservation methodology and conservation of historic materials. She is a fellow of the American Institute of Architects and the Association for Preservation Technology. So we're in great hands when it comes to historic preservation, so I'd like to turn it over to Sharon right now.
Good morning, everybody. Yes, I hope this is my capstone, but it's not the end of me. So, anyway, good morning. And Robert, you'll hear a little bit about his bio after me. And I are so pleased that we're going to tell you what we learned about the bell tower as we embark on its preservation. But before I start, I want to commend to you our own parishioner, Dick Grimmett's book, St. John's Lafayette Square, The History and Heritage of the Church of the Presidents. And you can get this on the church website. It really is a great read. I learned a lot. And I needed to refer to this to do this talk. So I don't always know everything, but Richard does. So we're going to talk about the bell tower with its revered bell by the son of Paul Revere, Joseph, and it was not part of the original 1816 Benjamin Latrobe building, but it came several years later. And luckily, the bell itself is in good condition, but the bell tower that we're working on is long overdue for reinforcement and recladding. And you'll hear a little bit more about that part. Now, on the left is Latrobe's watercolor of a simple Greek Revival building with a cupola over the main space. And note the damage in the background of the White House from the War of 1812. Latrobe had discussed an extended nave, but had never apparently considered the bell tower. On the right is the 1822 drawing by Baroness Hyde de Neuville, the wife of the French representative to the United States, and this drawing confirms the appearance of the church in 1822 at the time the additions were completed. Now, Latrobe died in 1820 in New Orleans of yellow fever, so he never got to see this part of the church. The first few years of St. John's were hard financially. There was $5,000 of debt resulting from having constructed the church. And the only way to increase the amount of funds for the church was to increase the number of pews, because the pews were sold or rented. And so operational funds came from these sales. And in this early 1860 photograph is the dominant configuration of what we see throughout history. The integrity of the design has been maintained all these years, even with some minor additions, such as the 1830s changes to the southeast to expand the altar area, or the later additions not seen here of the 1880s of the stair vestibules. This is the iconic view that we have all through history. Now, as we know, it is difficult to underwrite the cost of preservation when taking care of a national historic landmark. And over time, the church has always looked for more income. Now, here is parishioner and well-regarded engineer General Montgomery Miggs's idea of the maximum enclosure of space in 1867. Now, his heavy-handed Romanesque Tuscan tower and domed north addition would have just overwhelmed our elegant church here. So now, aren't you glad that the vestry decided not to fulfill that design? He even gave $100 as a contribution along with his design. So we're glad that they didn't do it. And one of the reasons not to have done that addition was there were a number of churches that were being developed at the time, including St. Paul's at Foggy Bottom, and it was drawing parishioners sort of away from St. John's. So it was a smart move not to expend a lot of money on a big project, particularly in the post-Civil War era. While we do not know the designer of the bell tower, its step design is beautifully proportioned. The tower has three tiers topped with a gilded dome and weather vane. The interior is ventilated by arched louvers on all four sides, and the bell is in the middle section. The bell tower is simple but elegant, pleasing proportions, interesting projections, and angles. You know, it's kind of octagonal to give good shadow line effect. So let's, the vestry meeting had asked me if I would, when I do this talk, give some Greek Revival lingo. So let's look and start at the top and identify some of these Greek Revival elements that make this so beautiful. The top tier, identified on the drawing as the third stage, supports the dome, round globe, and weather vane. The dome is encircled by two-stepped bases, and this transitions from a circular to a square with the louvered spaces by a cornice or water table shedding water, protecting the arched louvers. That cornice does. The flat panels around the arch are often called spandrel panels. The arch has nice definition with a key element at the top and spring-line blocks on the sides. And the engaged pilasters frame the 45-degree canting of the corners. Moving down to the second tier, we see the most articulation. The octagonal base is larger than the top one and holds the bell, as I said. There's a beautiful pediment or triangular section with an entablature that holds the horizontal banding, beautiful horizontal bandings, called triglyphs and metopes. The pilasters have a simple Doric capital, and there was a dentiled cornice with projecting little blocks like teeth. The louvers are slightly larger in this second tier than the third tier, and it gives a proportionality and a visual elongation of the tower as you look up at it, as it recedes and is actually getting smaller. The lowest or first tier is the square base, finished in stucco with a simple recessed panel. Now, for the Revere Bell, it was purchased in Boston in 1822 for $355. It was rung for services, days of public thanksgiving, deaths of presidents, notifications of fires. It is rung today for many of the same occasions except for the notification of fires. Now, the motivation for the bell and the bell tower may have come from a bit of keeping up with the neighbors. The Unitarian Church nearby on 17th Street had a Revere bell and did get a subsidy from the city to have it used to notify for fires. So St. John's felt it should have a bell as well, and they were able to get the same cash subsidy of $100 from the city. Now, the bell weighs 964 pounds, and it appears in good condition, and it's currently being assessed by a bell specialist. While we're in there, we should make sure everything is good. Following a few images from my journey to the top, this is the dome, ball, and weather vane that are gilded. The weather vane appears to always have been gilded, with the dome gilding slightly later, maybe even as late as 1920, We're still working on those dates, but these elements will be regilded as part of this project. Most of the cladding in wood and metal is in poor condition and clearly needs replacement. Luckily, the heavy timbers and most framing are in good condition and need only modest reinforcement. We can date a lot of the original work. I have a whole handful of nails that I've pulled from the different pieces of salvage wood coming down. And there's a difference between the cut historic 19th century iron nails and the round steel nails from the modern era. So part of what we're doing is documenting what we think is really original, which is a lot of it. And some of it is replacement. This is really interesting because in this view, the upper left is the underside of the entablature known as guttae, or little drops in Latin, and to the upper right is a section of the triglyphs and the flat panel metopes. Now, the wooden piece with holes in it is not a historic decorative piece. It is the handiwork of carpenter bees, which have been having a field day up there. So just in the trim pieces, not really in the heavy framing pieces. So early repair records also on the sanctuary indicated that there was at one time extensive termite damage. So this is one of the reasons we're selecting materials that are durable and not of interest to insects. The new materials that Robert will discuss can reproduce the architectural details perfectly and give a long service life. So we're going to switch over to Robert, and you'll hear a little bit about his background. But before I turn the mic over to him, I want to give a shout-out to our contractor from Worcester Eisenbrandt from Baltimore. Dave, Tom, Scott, and Mike, they're becoming my best friends. And several others are doing a great job. And they are working along with our owner, the church's owner representatives, Sean and Will Reagan, who oversee the schedule, budget, and keep everything on track. As Julia mentioned, there are two committees. There's the St. John's Bell Tower Committee and the St. John's Fundraising Committee, and you'll hear a little bit more about that later. So now, Julia, will you tell us a little bit about Robert and why we love him?
Thank you. Robert Allen is a principal with DLR Group Bowie Gridley and brings over 40 years' experience as an architect working with historic structures on various restoration, adaptive reuse, and preservation projects. Besides leading the restoration work on the St. John's Bell Tower, he is presently working on renovations to the historic parish house at Christ Church in Georgetown and the renovation and expansion of the historic little sanctuary at St. Albans School, located in the National Cathedral Close in D.C. He's also working with the renovation of the Hershey Theater and Community Building in Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is also on the list of historic places in the National Register. I also want to say Robert and his team have been with us every step of the way on this project, and we are incredibly grateful for both his expert guidance and his willingness to keep us all focused on the big picture. So with that, Robert.
I have been able to, in my career, to work on some amazing historic buildings. This certainly ranks up there in terms of importance and delight. And as we go through this, I'll try to share some of my passion for what clearly has been passionate for you. So I wanted to start out our talk today by talking about our initial investigation. So probably the very first step of this process involved really getting an understanding of the condition of the existing bell tower. To do that, we had commissioned a structural engineer actually two different times to do an evaluation of the building to confirm how much work was really necessary to do. The results of those studies, one in 2016 and the other in 2022, to update it, was that the building structure was very sound. However, as Sharon's photos show, there was some severely deteriorated trim elements and skin elements to the building. That is not uncommon in this type of building, especially because of the difficulty in maintaining this type of structure when it's above a slate roof. And we'll get into that because that whole issue of maintenance really does start to dictate how you approach restoration and preservation. We are very fortunate with this building. As part of our research, of course, we were able to look up what historic documentation there is available for the building. Besides the narratives and various paintings that we have, there were two sets of historic drawings we have relied on substantially. One is a set of measured drawings done in 1914, the title being Measured Drawings of Georgian Architecture, and that was published in 1914, and that had some wonderful plates, very detailed. And what was very interesting with that is that we could compare those drawings to photographs we took of the existing details to see what parts were from the original or older portion and what parts had been replaced over the years in terms of time. This is an example of the plate, but that plate, especially on the right, is wonderful. And these drawings have been furnished to the fabricator as well, who's comparing these drawings as well with the materials that we're taking off the building to make sure that we're accurate. The second set of drawings that we were fortunate to have access to is the set of drawings done in 1962 for the Historic American Building Survey, which is commonly known as HABS. That really kind of substantiated what was there in 1914. So it's actually the 1914 drawings that really were our greatest tool in terms of documenting what we needed to do. So I touched on that first question about historic restoration versus preservation. And one of the first questions always is, restore to when? Obviously, the building has a long storied history. Do we go to 1860? Do we go to 1914? Do we go to 1962? The building was recorded as a landmark in 1966, I believe. And in fact, we have pictures from 38 and 62, which we'll show in a little bit, that document very well. Most of our work is kind of a hybrid between those two periods. The 62 photographs indicate that some of the detail had deteriorated already and had been replaced with not exactly the right thing. The 38 drawing, the photographs really showed us what was there. And one of the interesting things that Sharon mentioned was the gilding of the cupola and the dome. There is conflicting information. Very clearly in 1962, it was gilded. There's writing that suggests it was gilded in the 20s. The 1938 photo isn't so sure. We discussed it with CFA, and they agreed that the gilding has been there at least for 60 years. We do know that originally, when it was built, the copper dome was not gilded. It was just copper. The second question is the impact of maintenance or ability to maintain it. One of the reasons why the condition deteriorated is because it's just so hard to get to the existing wood to paint it and to strip it and to do what's necessary. And that becomes a big issue in terms of longevity. The cost of scaffolding this building is almost $250,000 right now. So you can't really justify doing that every 5 years as you would like to if you're going to keep things up. And if you don't keep touching up and analyzing, you get the damage that you saw in Sharon's slides, like the carpenter bees that we saw tunneling through there. So that then really required us to look hard at what options were there for materials. And what it suggested is an approach where we would salvage the existing details that are in good shape, We would duplicate them. We would keep and keep part of your collection the existing historic details, but we now can reproduce those in a material that would give us a longest life so that we don't have to worry about it deteriorating in the future. And not only does that protect the bell tower detail itself, it also protects the structure below the bell tower, the rest of the church. So the materials that we looked at, we went through a pretty lengthy analysis. The original details on the building were pine. Now, the pine that they used isn't the same pine we can get now. And even if we could find sort of salvaged pine to try to get the durability, it just has a limited lifespan if it's not painted at least every 10 years. You know, the second thing we looked at is mahogany. We have used mahogany for restoration. Pretty durable material, still, again, subject to termite damage and repainting periodically. Again, it doesn't give us as much longevity. A third material we looked at is a treated pine, which is a very interesting material. They actually take pine and they treat it essentially with vinegar and acetic acid, and it has a very long duration. Unfortunately, it's also very expensive, almost double of the other things. So that was something we considered. But it still is not exactly the original material either. And then the fourth material, which is where we ended up, and I'm going to pass out some samples from Craig Baston, who's joining me today. Craig, by the way, is the person who's done all the drawings for this project. So he is very familiar with the project. It's a synthetic material. It's made from coal ash. It's dimensionally stable. It is absolutely water impervious, and it's been used recently on a very similar historic structure and other historic structures I can show you examples of. We have clients who have used it. We did some investigation. We reviewed it with the Commission of Fine Arts and gained their consensus that this made sense. And the advantage of this material is that it isn't going to need painting. Maybe it will need painting in 20 years. And even if it isn't painted, it's not going to rot. It will still be good. Here's some photos from 1938. This is where I say it does not appear in these photos as if the tower dome and the cupola were gilded at this point. There's conflicting information, but 62, very clearly it was. So, and that is the approach that we have taken for it. So the other detailing on the building, there are some metal roofs down there. You saw from Sharon's earlier photos, they had painted the coated material. That is copper also. It was probably what we would call turn metal. It was tin coated. We are going with a coated copper material also for those other elements, but that is not gilded. This is an interesting slide because it shows comparisons of existing structures that have been duplicated with this synthetic material. The top ones are some cornice details from a Brooklyn townhouse that was done, and you can see how carefully they're able to duplicate the detail. And part of it is they actually mill this product just like you would with wood. So that gave us a fairly high degree of comfort level that this was the right material for the project. We provided samples to the Commission of Fine Arts and brought it before your committee so they could see exactly what it is. It's a very solid and substantial material. And the samples you're passing around are the ones that we shared. Okay, approvals. So obviously we had to review this with your organization to get buy-in in terms of the approach. I think we went through the pros and cons, and I think everyone is pretty comfortable that we have a sound approach. Then in terms of documentation, what we utilize is primarily two things: annotated 1914 drawings that showed what we were replacing and how we were going to duplicate it, and then photographs, recent photographs that we put the same notation so that the Commission of Fine Arts could look and say, yep, I see what you're doing. Here's what it looks like now. We also gave them a lot of pictures of the deteriorated conditions. It was very clear that something had to be done, and that made it much easier for them. One of the other things that made this an easier thing to get approved is it was recently used for this restoration, which is now about 8 years old, for the Theodore Roosevelt High School. This, incidentally, was done by the same general contractor that's doing our restoration. So they were familiar working with this material. They had a track record. They knew the fabricator that we were talking about working with, and so it gave us, again, a very high degree of comfort. And then in construction, so you've seen a bunch of construction photos. As I mentioned, scaffolding and building access really is the key to this. It's a substantial portion of the cost. Literally $250,000 of work is just the scaffolding. Anytime we would need to do maintenance in the future, we're trying to avoid that And so that's why the decision was made to take the approach that we did. In terms of the demolition process, as they're going through the process, they're being very careful in terms of taking down things and providing samples to the fabricator who compares them to the original drawings. So we're confident that we are reproducing carefully. And I know the contractor's working carefully with your committee to salvage the materials that are coming down that are worth saving so that we have them for posterity. Here's a few interesting slides. That's a picture of the dome when you take all the copper off. And that wood is the original wood from the 1820s. It's still in very good shape. Now, part of why it's in very good shape is it's an open building. It really breathed a lot. So if there was any moisture, it mostly evaporated. The parts that are damaged were the ones that were painted over and concealed and the insects got in, or it just rotted over time. So these are just some pictures taken behind the curtain, so to speak, inside the scaffolding that you can see. And so like that element right there, that whole pediment is going to be removed. It'll be removed as a piece. Similar to what you saw in those Brooklyn mock-ups, the fabricator is able to compare that. And in terms of assembly, now we'll be able to kind of come back and assemble the whole thing together in one piece. So it's going to be a very efficient way to do this. And that is what it looks like just before we started, and we hope when we get done, it will look almost the same, except better. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Sharon and Robert. I just wanted to bring up my good colleague, David Galilee, to offer a few words for you, our sponsor. And David, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you. This is a wonderful opportunity to preach to the choir, because obviously if you're here today, you care about the bell tower and you care about preservation. So thank you very much for this presentation. Thank you all for coming to it. During the quiet phase, we had 33 contributions that raised $1.18 million. So that was a real, achievement on the part of the vestry, on the part of Rob, and, of course, on the part of the whole Bell Tower Committee. The goal is for about 1.87 to complete the whole project, and we're now very much out of the quiet phase. Many of you will have received information in the mail about the contributions. We do it both through our own committee, but also our great staff, Preston Cerrone and Charlene Griffin, are instrumental in making this whole process of the congregation contributing to the bell tower work. One other aspect of fundraising that I want to put out to the congregation, to our friends, is that we're looking beyond the St. John's community. We're looking for contacting historic families in Washington who have a deep commitment to St. John's. We're looking for our neighbors here in the Lafayette Square community. We're looking for foundations, organizations, individuals who have a particular interest in historic preservation. And if these entities are not interested in contributing directly to a church, we're setting up a 501c3 for the preservation of both the bell tower and St. John's going forward. So I ask members of the congregation to think about the people that you know in your social groups and your networks who might have an interest in St. John's, and please feel free to contact me directly or to contact Preston Cerrone, and then, of course, members of our committee. Before I close, I want to give a special thanks to a real professional fundraiser, Stephen Crochet from the Bishop Walker School, who has been the guy who's given us a great deal of guidance. People like me, I'm just a cheerful volunteer. So thank you. Thank you all for everything that you've done, and please let me know how I can discuss the fundraising of the Bell Tower funds with you individually. Thank you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. And I think where we want to do now, we have several minutes. So Sharon and David, if you could come up, we'll take your questions. I'll try and help field them. Hands. So and we'll try and repeat them so everyone can hear and we're capturing. So Jim, I see you right there.
My question is about the new material you're using, the poly ash. From looking at it, it seems it can be inculcated with color, and
That's a good question for Robert. The question is, can the poly ash be colored so that it removes the need to paint it?
So the answer is sort of. And what I mean by that is it actually cannot be integral to the material, but it can be factory or shop painted before it arrives here. So one of the things that, and one of the reasons why we like this approach is they can pretty much fabricate all the pieces, pre-finish them, and then there will be some touch-up, but it should be minimal. So we do anticipate it will require painting at some point, but, you know, the enemy of paint, more than anything else, is moisture penetration. And by controlling the environment by shop painting it, we already are taking care of 99% of the potential weaknesses, so we expect it will be durable.
Follow-up is, though, that does require that in the future that for the maintenance to occur, that scaffolding has to reappear.
It does. And we did actually look at options for kind of the build-in steeplejacks that could facilitate in the future. The cost became so prohibitive that we decided for the anticipated life of the product that, you know, there may be a better solution available in 20 or 30 years. So the question was, what's the difference between poly ash and another product that we use called AZAC? AZAC is a PVC product, so it's a plastic product, and we do use it on occasion for historic structures, but one of the disadvantages of AZAC is it has quite a bit of expansion and contraction. This product is dimensionally stable, so it's a big deal in terms of controlling joints, because now we don't have to worry about caulk the same way, trying to allow for that expansion contraction. The other thing about AZAC is that it's generally a formed or molded product. This is a milled product. And the difference there is that, and this was a big deal to the CFA and his SHPO, is that this we can literally duplicate the profiles. We did look at that as an option. I think when we came across this that was more dimensionally stable, we felt it was a superior choice.
And the cost difference?
It's not a huge difference. AZAC is not inexpensive. The concern was really more overridden by that sort of expansion contraction issue.
Okay. Martha?
I have two questions. One, it's not clear to me whether or not you're replacing all of the wooden structure. Is some of it being maintained? And if so, you know, those 1815 beams, are they going to be treated some way? My other question is, stucco in this climate doesn't resist moisture. Are we going to, is there any, what's being done on that front?
I'll let you take this.
So the first question is, what were we doing to, what was the condition of the existing beams, and were we doing anything to preserve their longevity? So the condition actually was very good. We're doing a couple things. Number one, we are treating them all again with chemicals in order to resist insect damage. We are keeping all the major structural beams, actually all of them, are in very good condition. Now the second thing that we're doing is part of why we want to maintain the integrity of the envelope, including where the louvers are, and make sure we have the right kind of screens, but doing it in a way that doesn't look like they're screened, is we want to make sure that we keep the insects and birds out. And they had mixed success over the years, as you could see from some of those photographs. We should have much better success now going forward, and that was a big deal in terms of how we detailed it.
The stucco.
We are doing stucco repairs. Stucco, by nature, I mean, it's a masonry product. We have better masonry additives now that we can do to extend its life. It will occasionally require attention, but it's not quite the same concern because there's masonry behind it. So we're less concerned about that, and the flashing that's integrated to it is being replaced, so it will control any water penetration to the roof.
Does Tier 1 stucco tie into the rest of the church? Is that why it's used there?
Yes.
The church has some stucco, or is it just trying to...
Yes. So that bottom part is actually, believe it or not, it's essentially masonry. It's like
right.
block, right?
Yeah.
So at the bottom of it, there is a copper flashing, which you can't see,
right.
that is going to be replaced as part of the roof slate replacement.
So when you come down to the walls of the main church, is some of the stucco as well?
Correct, that is. It's all, right, it's all stucco.
It's a tie.
Right, it all matches the existing.
Thank you, sir.
So that's a great question. The question was, are we going to reclad the dome with gilding, gold gilding, and was there any discussion about not gilding the dome? And the answer is yes, because the original 1822 drawings, it was just copper. And some of the older photographs really suggest it was just the dark copper. I think the consensus was it's been gilded at least for 60 years, possibly 100 years. And the thought was that it had really become part of the landmark. And so we went back and forth and decided that gilding did make sense. The other reason to gild it is that copper, by nature, when it patinas, it stains. And when you have white trim underneath it, if you get that green staining, while it does sometimes add to the character, it will become, again, potentially a maintenance item in the future. So by gilding it, we lessen the opportunity of that staining.
The question is, are the gold domes, particularly that we see around Washington, some sort of mid-19th century or 20th century popular thing to do to stand out and be beautiful? And I think the gilding of the domes of other buildings have been contemporary with those buildings themselves. So I think that you get a range. Some things were gilded, particularly like spear ends on fencing and things like that are historic of the time. And others are sort of a rethinking. But we feel pretty strongly that ours is compatible with the building and really very beautiful. So even if it wasn't at the original time, now we do know that the weather vane was always gilded. So, and you know, I'm not sure I said it, but when we were looking at the heavy design by Miggs, he did propose to reuse the weather vane. So, I mean, you know, I think there are certain things that catch people's eyes that they want to keep doing. But that was a good question.
The total project is 1.87, and we have close to 1.2.
I might also mention that the whole project does involve the reslating of the sanctuary, of the nave. So that is part of the overall cost. It's very hard to split things out too finely, but that's the price we're working with Worcester Eisenbrandt. Oh, well, thank you very much. We've had an offer from a volunteer to come help us in any way possible with painting, landscape, or whatever. Thank you. We'll get your name.
Is the pediment above the columns part of this project? What will happen to
I think as we, the question is the pediment as part of the portico with the columns part of this project? And actually it is not part of the project, but what I do find is, like anywhere, when you paint a little bit and it looks beautiful, it makes everything else look terrible. So I would imagine that that's something we're going to have to think about, but it's not part of this project. The question is, is the insect damage causing a lot of damage? Well, I would...
No, it's on the slate.
Oh,
like,
I'm sorry.
Why are we having to replace the slate?
What is the condition of the slate? Why does it need to be replaced?
The slate was worked on in the 1980s, and we did take... And I was part of that project. We did take the slate off the north side of the sanctuary, of the nave, and put it on the south side because that was the historic Buckingham blue slate, Buckingham slate. And we couldn't get our own slate, American, so we used a Spanish slate on the north side. And it has not held up well at all. It was too thin, too brittle, and it cracks every time you send somebody up to do any work. So the decision was, since we're getting the bell tower done, we will get our slate, really good quality slate from New England, on the sanctuary. So it's run out of its time.
Just in general, slate, while it is stone, it does actually become brittle over time. So typically, the lifespan of a slate roof is usually, we figure, 60 years-ish. And it's not just a slate. The other thing that can happen over time is the fasteners underneath that attach it also can deteriorate. And then, of course, the flashing underneath, which generally we use copper, but again, it has a limited lifespan. So it's when all the little details start to fall apart, you want to catch it before that happens, or else it does a lot of damage.
I think we are running up against our time limits. I want to thank our speakers again. Please join me in a round of applause. And I hope that, you know, this is how I feel when I listen to them, that suddenly I'm a little bit of an expert, or at least I know more about what's going on. And hopefully this has provided that same experience to you and also help you understand the complexity of this particular project and the level of skill, expertise, and dedication that this team is bringing to it. So... thank you all. We'll still be up here if you had any questions, except Rob, would you like to say?
I just wanted to say a couple things. First of all, a practical thing. Something is going on with the microphone, but I have good news. We are recording the whole thing, and there's a backup microphone that I understand is working. So you can rewatch all this, and you can see all the imagery again when it gets posted on our website. So that's good news. I also think it's really important that we thank three people in particular. We have an overall project manager for this important project, and then we have a head of the subcommittee, which is the fundraising portion, and a head of the subcommittee, which is the building portion. That building portion, the head of it is Chase Rind, who can't be here today. The head of our subcommittee for fundraising, of course, is David Galilee, and Julia Koster is the head overall, and I'm just so thrilled with the dedicated work that you guys have been doing. This is exciting and fascinating for me. They don't teach you in seminary about any of this stuff. We are very, very blessed at this church to have people who are knowledgeable. I'm looking at Stephen right over there, who have gifts and talents and that you share them so graciously. Thank you all. Let's give them a big thanks.